Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is John T. Edge, who's a good friend of lots of our friends here in Chapel Hill. He is the author of a new book called The Pot Liquor Papers, and it is the subtitle is A Food History of the Modern South. John T. Edge, welcome.
Thank you, D.G., very much.
Well, you are so many things that many of us would aspire to be, a contributing editor at Garden and Gun, running the Southern Foodways Alliance out of Oxford, Mississippi, that if you can't live in Chapel Hill, maybe Oxford, Mississippi is the next best place next best place to live. And have, for many years, written provocative pieces that put us in touch with our food, our Southern food, and this latest book makes us proud and conscious of how our food relates to our history. Well, rather than me talking about your book, tell us how this book got put together.
There are a lot of different origin points for this. I mean, in many ways, my mentor, John Edgerton, and I write a foreword to him in place of the foreword.
Let me interrupt you, and I promise I won't do this again, but when I read the introduction, I said, you know, a lot of people get these two guys mixed up.
Hey, that's how my career rose.
Is that anyway? But I thought the idea that in your introduction to him, because he usually wrote the introduction, or
he shepherded so many careers and encouraged so many people and buoyed this whole field of writing about food with depth and interest and conscience. And I think about Tony Tipton Martin, who recently published The Jemima Code, a great review of and catalog of African-American cookbooks. I think about so many people, Ronnie Lundy, who just published a recent book, Vittles, on Appalachian cooking. We all owe
She, by the way, is now North Carolinian.
She is indeed. Y'all are acquisitive folk.
We're going to grab you too before it's over.
I'm easily grabbed. I love the state.
So more about your relationship with Edgerton, and did other people say, "Hey, I thought"? Were you ever confused? Did you ever go out and say, "Oh, often. I read your book, and turned out it was Edgerton's book"?
I would try my best to disabuse them of that mistake, Yeah, our names are quite similar. He is Egerton, and I'm Edge. And I can't tell you how many books I've turned to the endnotes and seen his name spelled Egerton. So, yes, that interplay of our names. If anything, what I didn't borrow from him was his name. I borrowed from him his worldview, his kind of social conscience. He wrote a number of really strong, good books. But the two defining books of his career, I think, are his book Speak Now Against the Day, about the generation before the civil rights movement in the South, about the possibilities of this region. If we had accepted Brown v. Board, if our leaders had accepted Brown v. Board, if we had led towards the light instead of the darkness. And this whole range of radical Southerners who conceived a future tense South that we're still grappling toward now. And then this other straight up great book was Southern Food, At Home, On the Road, and in History. It was a social history of the South, one of the first to begin to pay down debts of pleasure owed to the farmers and cooks and the like who've sustained this region. So those two books kind of set out possibilities for me. And his mentorship, this kind of John was a real close talker. Like if you and I were talking, he'd be in your space, in your grill.
Oh, is that right? And was he preaching to you, or was he in conversation with you?
No, he wasn't preaching. He was encouraging. He was goading a little bit. He had a glass of whiskey in his hand, and he always made this beautiful lemon curd, which he gave out for presents. So, you know, I can imagine John, a glass of Tennessee whiskey in one hand, lemon curd on a piece of shortbread in another hand, encouraging, coaxing, working towards some better South, and embroiling you in it, engaging you in it,
and challenging you to write, not as as somebody who might be viewed as a rival, but as a cohort.
Right. Oh, no, no. There's such a free exchange of ideas and such a generosity of spirit and a want to stay out on John's part, stay out of the spotlight, do good work, help others do good work, and a real recognition that he wouldn't share or that he couldn't carry that whole burden. He needed to share it with others, wanted to share it with others. And that kind of spirit, I fail at following his lead often, but I know it and recognize that as a goal in my own life, is do good work, let others take credit for it.
Well, and what was the objective? What is y'all's objective in terms of dealing with our region and where you want to take us, or where you want to push us to take ourselves?
I mean, I recognize that at core, this region is a broken place. Mending, growing, progressing fitfully. And Edgerton did too, I think. He loved this place, and I do too. But I'm also angry at my region for our political and social history that's quite tawdry and tangled and corrupt. And yet I see the people of this region struggling, you know, from the beginning of this book in 55 to the arc of it closing in 2015, struggling towards a better South, a more inclusive South. I think the arc is a good one, and it arcs toward justice, as Dr. King would have it.
Well, that's a good segue back to the original question is, how did you put the book together? And you just mentioned that you start out about the time in the early 50s, about the time of Brown v. Board, mm-hmm. and to chronicle our food.
Yeah.
History, and you lead us through our political and social history all the time, telling us about the things that are happening. And you start out with Fannie Lou Hamer and talk about how food supported the civil rights movement in the early days.
Well, there are two African-American women who anchor really the first few chapters. And the first is Georgia Gilmore, and the second is Fannie Lou Hamer. And Georgia Gilmore is the propulsive character for the book. She comes on the scene in 1955 with the Montgomery bus boycotts. You know, and I think about that as the moment when the South truly begins to change. You see this propulsion forward, and you see it in the character of Georgia Gilmore. And she's you know, she's a midwife, and she lays tracks on the railroad at one point. She's a woman of great kind of physical strength and also great emotional and intellectual strength. She's a cook. As well. And when the Montgomery bus boycotts begin in 1955, she comes to the very first meeting of the Montgomery Improvement Association. When Dr. King steps to the stage to take leadership, when Rosa Parks stands and accepts applause for her refusal to step to the back of the bus. And Ms. Gilmore recognizes that, okay, if the black citizens of Montgomery are going to set up this alternate transportation system, they're going to quit the segregated buses of Montgomery, they need gas for the station wagons that the churches are going to drive. They need brakes on the cars that, you know, everyday citizens are going to ferry folks around to get the cooks and maids in Montgomery to work. And so she begins frying chicken, quite literally, and making chicken and white bread sandwiches. She begins baking pies and cakes. She takes the knowledge that she gleaned in kitchens and applies them quite literally to fuel the civil rights movement. And she did this behind the scrim of what she called the Club from Nowhere. And that club was women like her working, cooking, baking to raise money for the bus boycott. And then when you said it, where does it come from? It came from nowhere. Wow. Gave them a scrim of anonymity and protection.
So there was – I'm putting words in your mouth, and I hope you're going to disagree with me. But there was no really dramatic revolution in food. It was the way that the historic ways of looking at – for each other supported a civil rights movement that was critical in terms of moving our region forward.
Yeah, I mean, this book is not so much about food. It's a way of understanding the South through food. And that's why I subtitled this A Food History of the Modern South. It's not a history of Southern food. Food offers us a way to appreciate.
You point us towards Southern history through the binoculars of what we're eating and what's developing in the way of food.
Is it's almost like, you know, saying to you, like, you like fried chicken, right? You love barbecue, and you're smiling now, like your face is creased with this big grin. And my responsibility as a writer is to kind of complicate your love of fried chicken and barbecue and black-eyed peas and rice to tease out the stories, the narratives embedded in those foods, because like the South itself, they're tragic and triumphant and everything in between.
Well, you mentioned fried chicken, and you tell us so much about where these foods came from. I'm not sure I really understand, even after reading your book, why fried chicken is so prevalent, both in both races, right, and rich and poor. And kind of we're really proud of – nobody else can cook fried chicken the way my grandmother did, or the person who was – you know, the maid in my household.
Right.
She really had it better than anybody else.
Right.
We've got this pride. So where did it come from?
I mean, that's a long and complex answer to come. But no, but I mean, it's – I mean, on its base – I mean, one of the things I think that Southerners tend to do, and I'm not accusing you of this or even suggesting this is you, but you know, we tend to kind of essentialize our conversations about Southern foods, Southern cultural outputs, and say the South is the only place to get great fried chicken, or the South is the place to get good fried chicken. In many ways, fried chicken at its best and at its roots is a rural dish. You know, this was, you know, the bird plucking out in the yard that you might wrench its neck and pluck its feathers on a Sunday and cook for a special occasion. So that happened just as well in the Midwest as it did in the American South. And, you know, people like Calvin Trillin, Bud Trillin, has written beautifully about his Kansas City youth and his love of fried chicken in the Midwest. And I've eaten my way following Trillin's trail, and it's great stuff. I think what happened in the South is we tend to use foods as a way to understand a place. And expertise in the rural South, especially among African American women, the South developed this beautiful technique. Women learned over generations, standing before stoves, cooking in cast iron skillets, they learned how to cook fried chicken beautifully. What happened in the 1970s, and I write about this in the book, as fried chicken, which is at this point kind of a symbol of hearth and home, and those African-American women standing before stoves cooking fried chicken, as Colonel Sanders kind of picks up the drumstick.
I want to take a break before. You've got a wonderful story about Colonel Sanders in your book, and I hesitate to interrupt you, but
you
just
do
need
anything
to.
You want.
We're going to take a break. If you join us late, I'm visiting with John T. Edge. He's the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, writes and is an editor of Garden and Gun, and his new book is The Potlicker Papers. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is John T. Edge. We're talking about his new book, The Potlicker Papers, a food history of the modern South. And we've been talking about fried chicken, and my mouth is watering. But there's more to fried chicken than just our traditional chicken. Fried chicken became a big business in the South.
Yeah.
We're getting ready to tell the Colonel Sanders story. And I want to give you all the time you need to tell the story.
The Colonel requires a lot of bandwidth. But fried chicken became an icon of the South because of its associations with hearth and home, because of its associations with expert African-American cooks, many of whom worked in white homes, and fried expert bird. The third piece of this, though, is the kind of the commodification of fried chicken. When Colonel Sanders comes on the scene in the 1960s and introduces modern ways of cooking chicken, faster ways of cooking chicken, broasting is what you hear it often called. It's a pressure-cooked fried chicken. So he took this hyper-traditional bird, which you would have had to go out in the backyard and pluck. You would have had to cook long and carefully in a cast iron skillet. And he turns it into, by way of cooking it more quickly, into this very modern food. That you can cook in just a few minutes. And as the commercial broiler industry begins to develop and chickens become more readily available, that dovetails with Sanders. And he sells fried chicken in pasteboard boxes and cardboard tubs. Colonel Sanders drapes himself in this kind of plantation outfit, you know, the white suit, the black tie, the bleached goatee. He's selling a plantation South. He's selling a South past, and he's speeding it up at the same time. It's a great way of thinking about the way the South changes and continues to rely on those kind of tropes of its past, of its plantation past, its agricultural past.
Yeah, but he was kind of a made-up figure for the businessmen who took over his business and took it international.
Yeah. So the businessmen who bought into Kentucky Fried Chicken, they not only bought his secret recipe of herbs and spices, they bought him. And he became their living, breathing mascot, you know, who would show up on What's My Line, the television show, or would travel the country in his roles, or travel Louisville, really, in his Rolls Royce kind of spry. And he called it colonelizing when he would kind of talk to people about his chicken and bring new franchisees on. He became the ultimate salesperson for fried chicken and also the ultimate salesperson for kind of the entrepreneurial possibilities of restaurants. So you see, out of the Colonel Sanders moment, you see Mahalia Jackson's fried chicken system, a fried chicken chain developed to leverage black capital and knowledge, build black jobs in the 1970s. They referred to this, the investors, white investors working in partnership with black investors, they referred to it as a business relationship, not a plantation ship.
Yeah, but Colonel Sanders, as you just described him, was the image of the plantation South and appealing to me, to an old white, you know, Confederate guy. But there must have been a crossover appeal to African, some African Americans, but some must have said, heck no, I don't want to buy into this. This system, but Colonel Sanders is still thriving as a business, even though it's been transformed. But I don't, other than in your book, I don't remember the
Mahalia Jackson.
Yeah.
No, I mean, to me, the Mahalia Jackson enterprise failed in large part because of the hubris of the business people who did it. They leveraged that personality, Mahalia Jackson, the great gospel recording artist, but they didn't know how to fry chicken. And they were hubristic enough to believe they didn't even need to know how to fry chicken. And Colonel Sanders at least really did develop this recipe, perhaps borrowed from some of his own, the cooks who worked with him. But he developed this recipe, cared deeply about it. And you see in him in later years, and I write about this in the book, there's this anger in Sanders. Sanders was a remarkably good cursor. Sanders was angry about what his fried chicken became, and I kind of think he was almost he recognized his complicity in taking this traditional food and modernizing it, perhaps not to the good.
Well, you talk about him visiting the restaurants and then critiquing them. I can't remember exactly the images, but it was like they're taking my good chicken and putting cake on top of it, or they're
a dough ball on top of a drumstick.
Yeah. Or they're taking my great gravy, and you can't even put up wallpaper with that gravy.
Right.
I mean, these are mean-spirited critiques of Colonel Sanders' chicken as it developed under the leadership of business people.
And they're implicit critiques of those business people who took this food that Colonel Sanders developed and then, you know, commodified it, sold it, New York Stock Exchange appearances for the Colonel, and the Colonel was selling and shilling for corporations, and the Colonel got agitated.
This is an interesting story. The commercialization of fried chicken is a very fascinating and challenging part of your book, but similarly, biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we take great pride in our biscuits, but the commercialization and fast foods has, in some cases, destroyed biscuits. Some people figured out how to do it better, including some people in North Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating to me, too. I mean, it's linked to the Colonel Sanders story. We tend to think about fast food as something that was visited upon us by Ray Kroc and the McDonald brothers, you know, something that came out of California, that came out of the Midwest, when the reality is smart entrepreneurs in the American South, Hardee's, you know, a chain that begins out in Greenville, North Carolina.
Tell that story, because I think a lot of people have forgotten it now. Yeah, it's been 40 years or 50 years.
Wilbur Hardee sets up shop across from what's the school there?
It's East Carolina.
Yeah, from East Carolina. I guess it was called East Carolina College then. He sets up shop there, and he is following the McDonald's model. He sees the possibilities in these charbroiled burgers. And he is selling this kind of modern drive-in South, clean and kind of post- barbecue, next phase in what a faster food might be for the South. What gets really interesting for those of us who care about Southern food is the next generation of franchisees after Hardee begins to expand, who develop drive-through biscuits, and they promise to consumers that these biscuits will be made by hand. They begin to roll out toward the front of the restaurant.
So you can see it.
So you can see, you know, the implied grandmother with a cirrus of gray curls making biscuits before you. And they are mixing fat into flour. They're using real buttermilk. You know, it's turning, like Sanders did, it's turning this hyper-traditional food into a very commodified commercial food. It's taking something that, you know, you would have walked into a country store and bought, or you would have walked to the kitchen in your home and your father or mother would have made you biscuit. And now you're getting it through the drive-thru. It's changing what we think of as Southern food.
Well, now, some of the fast food people are selling biscuits, but they're not selling the real Southern biscuit.
I don't know what's real, but it's you know, I grew up. I'm 54 years old, and so I grew up with Hardee's as much as I did. And a Hardee's is a higher crown biscuit, a kind of higher fat biscuit too. I grew up with those kind of biscuits. I've only come later in life to love the low crown biscuits, which are what you may think of as a real biscuit, you know, something that is not goosed with all kinds of polyunsaturated or saturated fat. You know, those biscuits, those kind of low crown biscuits, are what you might think of as a traditional biscuit. I would argue now, though, that when people think of biscuits in the South, you know, Bojangles, Hardee's, you know, and I love the way now, as we see an expansive South bringing so many new immigrants here, the way that people on both sides of the Mexican-American and American divide refer to Bojangles as Bojangles.
Well, if you joined us late, I'm visiting with John T. Edge. We're talking about his new book, The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you joined us late, my guest is John T. Edge. John is the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance. He's got lots of friends in Chapel Hill. Those of you who read Garden and Gun will recognize him as a regular columnist and an editor, as a contributing editor. He lives in Oxford, but he's got lots of friends in Chapel Hill. And a significant part of your book deals with our experience with food in Chapel Hill.
Yeah.
And I guess the story of Bill Neal's or Claiborne's discovery of Bill Neal and what that launched. If that hadn't have happened, would we be on the map? If Bill Neal had not been discovered, what would have happened?
I think y'all certainly be on the map, perhaps in a different way. Perhaps it had been someone else who might have stepped.
Tell us the story of Bill Neal and the discovery.
Sure. So, you know, this is the early 1980s, and Craig Claiborne, a son of the Mississippi Delta, grew up in his mother's boarding house among African-American cooks from whom he learned and whom he respected. Claiborne rose quickly out of the Delta, out of Columbia journalism, to become the food editor of the New York Times. And as food editor of the Times, he traveled and reported from Vietnam. He reported from across the U.S., and he reported from Chapel Hill. Where he ate.
Why did he even come to Chapel Hill? Do you know that?
Why did he come to Chapel Hill? He loves barbecue. Claiborne loved barbecue and was drawn by going to like Honey Monk's place.
Honey Monk's place in Lexington.
Uh-huh. Yeah. He was drawn by Honey Monk's place. He was also drawn by the rumors he'd heard of this young, new, brave, bold chef, Bill Neal. And Claiborne, if I recall, described Neal as the sort of chef who sees value in food in the way others see value in architecture and great literature. And I think that Claiborne saw in himself I think Claiborne saw in Neal a young version of himself, a studious, bright pupil of the South and of Southern food. And Neal, over the course of a couple of months, ate at Crook's twice and reported in the Times twice. The second time is the kind of coronation.
This is Craig Claiborne's reports.
This is Claiborne reporting
into the
Times.
Was he at Crook's Corner or was it at Residence?
He was at Crook's Corner. Claiborne reports in that, you know, we've found the next great American chef. We've found the great interpreter of Southern cuisine, and he is Bill Neal. And he's doing this reporting, you know, at a time when, you know, there are pig sculptures on the roof at Crook's. There's a playfulness to that restaurant that shines through. And one of the ways that Claiborne introduces kind of the future of Southern food to the New York Times readers is by writing about shrimp and grits, which
tell us
emerged.
The shrimp and grits story, because now, of course, we go to Crook's for shrimp and grits and every other restaurant in the South. What's that story?
I mean, there was a time back in the 80s when you talked of shrimp and grits to those who didn't grow up, say, in the low country of South Carolina and in shrimping communities. And it sounded as odd as chicken and waffles might have sounded 10 years ago when you heard people first talking about chicken and waffles broadly and widely. Chicken and waffles have been cooked for generations in the South and in the North, too. But those dishes, those queer-seeming combinations of chicken and waffles or shrimp and grits sounded odd in that moment. And Claiborne fell in love with that dish,
At Bill Neal's restaurant.
At Crook's Corner, yes. Mm-hmm. So he ate dinner at Crook's and then the next day goes to Bill Neal's apartment and sets up his IBM on the water heater, if I think I recall this correctly. Sets up his IBM, and as Neal begins boning quail and shelling shrimp, Claiborne's typing out his story. He's transcribing what Neal is doing, conversing with Neal, and then he publishes his full-throated praise for what the future of Southern food might be.
Based on Bill Neal's back. Is that
based
what
on Bill Neal.
He's making him the Jesus of the Southern food movement.
Well, in a way he did. I mean, it was – Claiborne was looking for a champion of Southern food. He worried about the future of Southern food at the moment. And that's a continuing theme through this book. But various times in our region's history when people wring their hands and gnash their teeth and wonder what's going to happen with Southern food. And Claiborne was asking himself this question in the early 1980s when he shows up at Crook's Corner and sits down, eats this meal, comes away from it impressed, and then asks Bill Neal, tell me what you do, tell me how you do it.
Wow. Wow. Well, that's a great story there, and it's covered even in more detail in your book. There are other North Carolina people featured in your book, and you mentioned barbecue and mm-hmm. that Craig Claiborne came to North Carolina first to maybe visit the Honey Monk's Lexington barbecue. But you've gone east in your description of modern times about what's happening to the wonderful Skylight Inn and the people who run that. This is in Aden, I guess, near Greenville. Sam, what's happening there, and what does it mean for modern barbecue aficionados and the rest of us who want to get a $3 barbecue mm-hmm. sandwich?
I don't know about the $3, but we can talk about a $6.
Tell me about it.
So, you know, this is connected to that earlier moment, you know, when Craig Claiborne wondered about the future of Southern food. For the last 20 years, a number of us, those of us who care about barbecue and think of it as kind of the South's great folk food, This democratic small D food that's for everyone. Been worried about it. Like, when's the last barbecue joint, last great barbecue joint going to close? Is the EPA going to shut barbecue pitmasters down for smoke pollution? Are the health departments going to finally say you can't cook whole hog in a screened room? There's a lot of worry. And I think one of the best answers to is there a future for barbecue resides in Aden and Greenville, the outskirts.
Tell us that story. That's kind of a new story for us here in Chapel Hill, but and an important one.
It is. Sam Jones, whose family has long been the stewards of Skylight Inn in Aden, beautifully done barbecue, a kind of pilgrimage site for many for a whole hog barbecue. Sam, I guess it's 2 years ago.
This is the youngest.
Younger Sam. Samuel Jones. Grew up in the barbecue restaurant in Aden, grew up in the Skylight Inn. And 2 years ago, Samuel Jones decides that the future of barbecue is not imperiled. And one of the ways to express that, one of the ways to make that clear, and one of the ways, quite frankly, for him to build a business that will truly support his family, is that he was going to open in a parking lot out parcel, like not far from a Walmart. He's going to open this kind of temple, grand temple of barbecue and its possibilities. He's going to do it the same way he does it back in Aden, 12 miles away, the same open pit, the same burn barrel, the same mechanism to burn down wood into coals, the same whole hogs, the same chopping block. And you know, when you walk into a great barbecue restaurant, it's not always about the smoke, right? It's about what you hear. And you hear that staccato knife on a block at Skylight and also at Sam Jones Barbecue in Greenville. He built, in essence, a $2 million barbecue restaurant.
But yeah, $2 million, so and I don't know what the facility in Aden has been depreciated to. It is probably close to zero value.
You look at me kind of querulously when I say that. So you don't think barbecue's worth that?
I think it's worth everything, but I enjoy paying what I would have been paying at the Skylight Inn versus what I've got to pay to fund the repayment of debt for $2 million.
So you seem well attired here. You seem like a pretty flush guy. Just got back from the beach. You don't want to pay $3 more for a sandwich?
I don't. I mean,
really?
My parents grew up in the Depression,
I grew up in the oversight.
So this is really what's on, you're getting to what's really on my mind as I watch Wilbur struggle, as I watch Honey Monk's struggle, and the other wonderful in the great barbecue places that we've got right here north of Chapel Hill and south of Chapel Hill struggle to be able to offer something which is not only great barbecue but also something which the mass of people can afford, so that when I go in, it's not just businessmen and ties, it's a whole selection of people. When you start having to pay back $2 million, I've seen so many restaurants collapse under the weight of that debt.
You know, and I think you're getting caught up in that dollar number, and I think that dollar number is a great flash in a way of establishing worth. And I said a moment ago, I think the real value of barbecue is in its democratic principles and its democratic promises, a food of all the people. It's not a food that we delineate based on class. And I would argue that what Samuel Jones has done out in Greenville is not that either. You know, if you want to go to Aden, 11 miles away, you can find that less expensive sandwich if you want. What's important, though, is I think Sam is bridging the gaps between environmental and family responsibilities and building a business that truly can survive for the future. And there's a gap there between Aden and Greenville. And Sam is, I think, filling that gap beautifully and building a business that will sustain for generations, sustain his family, and using pork and other ingredients that will sustain North Carolina. Yeah. So there's a negotiating act there, and I agree completely. But I think his intents are good. I think his business plan is good. And I think what he's doing shows a bright future for barbecue, something that will survive, that we won't worry about. You're worried about the future.
Thank you for that. That's great. Well, we have the same thing going on closer to home in Durham at Picnic, which is a wonderful whole hog place with hogs that happy hogs that are raised.
Right.
And we love this, but these guys have, and they're wonderful business people. They've had to invest a lot of money in it. And so and you ask if I'm willing to pay $6 or $7, and the answer is there. Yeah, I am, because it's good. All right, we got to stop because we've got to take a break. If you join us late, I'm visiting with John T. Edge and having a hard time not breaking in his wonderful story as he's got in his new book, The Pot Liquor Papers. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. If you join us late, I'm visiting with John T. Edge. We're talking about his new book, very, wonderfully received so far, and it's called The Pot Liquor Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. And John Edge, when we first talked, you reminded us that this is a food history,
right,
and it is a history. And so how do you – and you talk about how food interrelated with the challenges of the last 50 or 60 years. Where are we now?
Wow. Where are we with food or where are we with the South?
With the food history of the South and how food is related to how we're approaching some really extraordinary challenges that are built on kind of some things we should be proud of in terms of how we've dealt with their past and overcome it and built on it.
I think we are at a moment in our region's history when we are really just beginning to truly appreciate the value of our food culture. There's beautiful work being done here at the University of North Carolina by scholars like Elizabeth Engelhart and Marcy Ferris, who are writing smart, important books about our food history as Southerners. Elizabeth, especially about the contributions of women. So I think the kind of groundwork is being done for us to understand our past through food. The question will be, will we leverage that for a better South? Will we as Southerners recognize both the horrors of our past and the triumphs of our past? Can we manage those? Can we kind of pay down the debts of pleasure that we've accrued to the generations of cooks who went before us and farmers who went before us? And does that reckoning set us up for a brighter, more inclusive future? And I see that in glowing ways in the Triangle, in a place when, if you talk about like what's the future of meeting threes in the Triangle, or meeting twos, y'all may call it that, a plate lunch, are those businesses falling by the wayside? I think another way of thinking about that is to look at the Vietnamese restaurants serving pho, to look at Indian restaurants serving a beautiful basmati rice curry lunch. Those are kind of the future tense meat and threes, the future tense mom and pops of the South. Might not be the mom and pop you expected or you grew up with, DG, but those are moms and pops who claim the American South, turning out everyday working class food for everyday working class people. I think that spells a bright future for this region as it continues to diversify as the region and the nation kind of accommodates its demographic destiny. Like, this place is changing and the processes of Southern food are changing. I embrace it.
What about more than food? What about where does the South stand in terms of dealing with itself and its past and opportunities in the future, or are we going to come tumbling down on ourselves as we try to adjust?
I think we have to grapple with that past. And you see the arguments over memorials here in Chapel Hill, certainly in New Orleans where I was last week.
So you were there for the takedown of Robert E. Lee?
I was not. I arrived after the takedown. And as I drove about town, there were especially at the Jefferson Davis Memorial, I remember seeing that there was some stump sitting going on. The Lost Cause tree had been cut down, and there were people arrayed around it with Confederate flags doing what might as well be stump sitting, mourning their loss. The questions about that are thorny. But as someone who believes in the historical record, and I believe in the contextualization of memorials, as a way to address this. And yet, it's hard because I work on a University of Mississippi campus, and there's a Confederate memorial right at the top of the circle there, and the plaque that was added for contextualization is awful small.
It's awful. Like, well, yeah,
it's, not like
well,
a, it's not like
one
a fair
of the most
fight.
Poignant parts of your book, when you talk about this little boy growing up in Oxford, Mississippi,
yeah.
He goes into the tourist place where they've got Civil War hats for sale, mm-hmm. and this little boy, whom you know very well, chooses a blue cap rather
yeah.
than the gray cap. And I mean, for me, it just brought tears to my eyes thinking about your pride and also, oh my gosh, he has moved out of the history that I shared. I mean, tell us
yeah.
about that.
Yeah. So as a boy, my father took me to the Cyclorama in Atlanta. The Battle of Atlanta depicted there, and you go through the tour, and at the end, you exit into the gift shop, and you have your opportunity to buy something. And I was born in the home of a Confederate brigadier general in Georgia, and I bought a gray kepi cap. I bought a Confederate cap. It's the past I knew. My son, after a tour, who's now 16, and he was probably 11 or 12 when we took this tour, went to the Vicksburg battlefields, and we tramped up and down the greensward. We stared up at those soaring obelisks, we are headed back after that walk to the gift shop. And my son stops and talks to a park ranger. And I try to give him some space, and I can see he's asking questions of the park ranger, and we adjourn to the gift shop. My son makes the circuit, comes up to the register, and here he is with a blue kepi cap. And I ask him why. He said, well, because the North fought to end slavery.
Well, what a wonderful moment that I'm still thinking about, and a wonderful moment. Thanks for sharing these stories with us here on this program, and also many more in your book, The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. John T. Edge, thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thanks for the great questions.
Thanks to all of y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.